In the UK, Ling Pang interviews people from all around the world, and she is Bondi Tunes International.
Bondi Tunes, playing all over the planet now.
This is Ling Pang for Bondi Tunes International, and I talked with lead vocalist Stephen Kalasu of Odyssey, courtesy of Livewire. How are you?
Hi, I'm very well, thank you. And yourself?
I'm very well, thank you. Back in the 70s and 80s, Odyssey was a disco musical force. So popular, regular appearance on Top of the Pops, disco shows were huge in those days. You must be so proud of Odyssey.
Oh, I'm immensely proud, I have to say. And speaking of Top of the Pops, there's an episode where we did Going Back to My Roots. You can see it on YouTube. If you look to the right of your screen, there's a kid with a big afro playing guitar. I have no idea who that kid is, but they say he looks a little bit like me. And because, of course, I'm far too young to have been there. Wink, wink.
You come from a musical family, and I believe Odyssey began with your mum being one of the founders of the band, and they started singing and performing as early as the 60s.
Yes, it absolutely is correct. It started out as the Lopez sisters, my mom and her two sisters. There was a group even before that, but yes, it was the Lopez sisters, and it was my mom and Louise, who everybody knows later from Odyssey, and my aunt Carmen, who retired from the group. The show business was a little bit not to her liking, and she left the group to marry. And so my mom and aunt pretty much concentrated on songwriting and doing things like that. And Odyssey came about in the 70s when the city of New York was like nearly bankrupt. My brothers and I, we were teenagers, or almost young men just about, not going to school. There was no work to be found. It was a horrible time in New York. It's a very dangerous city. It was not a nice place to be in the mid-70s. So Odyssey was kind of formed as a means to pay the rent, to be perfectly honest. Mm-hmm. We had a lodger named Tony Reynolds, who was the original bass player in Odyssey. My brothers and I, my aunt, my mom, and we would get extra musicians, and we started doing the tourist circuit around New York to, as I say, pay the rent and for my mother to be able to feed three grown men, practically.
Your mom and aunt were so beautiful and attractive-looking ladies.
I think you're absolutely right on that. Sometimes when I see old footage, especially, you know, in the Odyssey era, and I see my mom and I think, oh, wow, look at my auntie. My goodness, look how young they are. And then I stop and do the math and I think, whoa, wait a minute. They were pretty old ladies by the time a lot of this footage was taken, but they just retained their amazing beauty, right? Well into their 70s.
So, Stephen, did you have any interest in music from early on in your life, or you already love music literally from birth?
Almost from birth. From my earliest recollection is about two and a half. There was always a piano in my house, our house, and I could reach up standing on the floor. And anything that I heard on the television, not anything, but most things that I heard, I could reach up and pick it out, even though I couldn't see the keys or reach the keys of the piano. And started my first musical collaboration with a kid who lived just over the road from me when I was about 8, and he was 9. And I had a little toy keyboard, he had a guitar, but we used to get together at each other's house and we started working on, you know, little 8 and 9 year old compositions. But, you know, the interest was always there. And long before Odyssey, actually, I'd become a professional in the music industry in my teens.
Odyssey's 80s mega hits, were they a surprise to your mom and aunt?
Well, Native New Yorker wasn't a huge surprise, I have to say, because as I mentioned, it was New York was the morale of the city was just at an all-time low.
Here is Native New Yorker.
Thank you.
And so when that song came out, it just sort of reminded New Yorkers of who we are and what we're made of. And I think for that reason alone, because the song was done previously by Frankie Valli, who people might know from the Four Seasons.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah.
He recorded the song first. But things hadn't gotten in New York to quite the point that they did by the time we recorded it and did it and released it in 77, where, like, as I say, New York was just about the rock bottom that it could be. And so it wasn't a real big surprise when the song took off, because it was just the thing that was needed at that time. As for the rest, those are all hit and miss. Our next album, Nothing, came off of that album, second album, and then it was the third album that the top 10 hits really started coming, you know, fast and furious and beyond.
Beautiful songs. Also special is that when you watch Odyssey on Top of the Pops, always look happy and cheerful, and they give you a lift.
I've heard, and I don't want to blow my own horn, this is just what I've been told, that is the one thing that, even as I continue with the legacy today, that many of people who come to see our shows still say about Odyssey. They even say I look like my mother, even though I don't see it. But that same thing comes across when we just always have a good time. And when you have a good time, you give your audience permission to have a good time. And that seems to have carried through me.
You'll continue with the legacy of the band. Your mother would be proud of you.
I like to think so. I like to think that she's always with me. She visits me and my aunt. And I'm immensely grateful for all of the over the years, over the decades now, of the immense array of talent that has come through to assist me in carrying on with this legacy. I couldn't have done it without each and all of them, of the musicians, singers, others, you know, who have helped me to keep this legacy moving forward. It's I've been incredibly blessed, and I like to think that Mom would be very proud. I'm sorry she didn't get to meet so many of the people that I've been working with, especially over the last 10 years.
Tell me about the current setup of the band.
The members of the group are not the Peter sisters anymore. They're kind of long gone now. I have two ladies who record with me. One by the name of KJ. Her name is Kate Sutherland, but we call her KJ. And another lady by the name of Michelle John, who also records with us and has been gigging with me and touring with me. And they are my two ladies now of Odyssey.
When you're on stage, visual, costumes, choreography, all blending together. Do you also are responsible for the design and staging?
Yes. Actually, as far as the staging, I have a sort of loose but tight sort of guideline. We do what I call eyeball choreography. What that is that basically we're all good enough dancers where we all just sort of join in. We almost know instinctively what moves the other's going to do. And so we all have a way of just falling in together, and it always looks like we designed it, you know, months ago, even though we're doing it live and spontaneously in that moment. And as far as the costuming goes, the one complaint I think I have about some modern entertainers, I insist that we have to look like we meant to come here and perform for people, not like we just picked up our jeans off from the side of the bed from last night and t-shirt and just threw it on to come and do this show. No, I want us to dress up, wear proper performance clothes, you know, clothes that simply say we've made an effort to come here tonight to perform for you.
The time has changed since the 80s. And how do you find that the music and the style appeal to the younger fans?
Well, that's the wonderful thing that the whole era, even with the modern music, a lot of it is sampled from old music, from the 70s and the 80s music. And a lot of young people have become curious about where, because they all know it's sampled and it's old stuff just redone and reimagined. And so we have an amazing following, and particularly here in Britain, it's also the fact that the parents play this music, our music, grandparents play our music for kids. And as bad as we may think they are, these even will be the good old days for our grandchildren. And yeah, so we even do a few gigs, several a year throughout the country, where it's all young people. I mean, we call them the kiddie gigs. I mean, we're talking about very young adults, of course, 20 years old, 25. But when you consider that our music was made 30 years before a lot of them, well, 20 years at least, before a lot of them were even born. But they know about it because it still gets played on commercial radio, the BBC, throughout a lot of countries, and still gets occasional play in the clubs.
I want to know more about Odyssey moving over to UK. I love to play another song. Would you like to tell me which song you want to play?
Well, this particular Odyssey track marks a sort of a move over, sort of going back to our roots, so to speak. More about that later. But it was a sort of change of direction for Odyssey. It's a song called Inside Out, and it's one of my favorite Odyssey tracks.
City life surround you, and she's always on the phone, but you just don't think that you can fight it. Don't give up, 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 darling, what you dream. It's like the words here in this song.
You said Odyssey has been very busy since you arrived in the UK 25 years ago. Do you think that the 25 years in the UK have helped Odyssey to develop the band even further to the fans across the world?
Absolutely. First of all, we had more hits in the UK than we did in the United States. And the reason for that was, I guess I'll have to just say that there's a different, a kind of segregation that existed in the music industry back in the day. And basically, the short of it was that black artists were supposed to perform a certain kind of music, supposed to have a certain kind of sound, if you like, which Odyssey didn't precisely conform to. We did all kinds of stuff, all kinds of flavors, all kinds of influences and things like that, which were at our time just unheard of. So it was very difficult for the label to market us. They just didn't know, you know, we weren't black enough to be black and weren't white enough to be white and weren't green enough to be green. So they didn't know, they couldn't figure out how to market the group on, with such a broad range of material. In the UK, there wasn't that same element of segregation. If they liked a group, a band, whatever its makeup, whatever color the group was, whatever influences it had, or whether it had several different, it didn't matter. So if you listen to all of our top five hits, none of them sound like the other one. The only common denominator, except for going back to my roots, is my mom's voice. That's the only thing that ties them all together. But otherwise, it would be difficult to even know that it was the same band because the music is so different. And yet they all five of those, plus some others that were what we call turntable hits that got played in the clubs and played at the Blue Light house parties, you know, kind of thing.
Did your mom, Lillian, retire from music or continue to perform until her last days?
No, she did retire. I took over the band in the early millennium, I think, maybe 2006, 7 somewhere. You have to forgive me. I'm a little vague on it. That's not the time I actually like to think about, to be honest. But somewhere around 2006, 2007, maybe we did one last big tour, last big arena tour. And from then on, the traveling back and forth, because she lived here sometimes in the UK, and then mostly she lived in Florida, in a part of Florida that was quite remote, not reasonably close to an airport and things like that. So it began to take a toll on my mom as she got older. And a bit further down the road was the early stages of cancer, and so that made things even harder for her. And so gradually, that's where I had to start looking for other singers and trying to keep it going. When she finally just retired and said, listen, you know what, I just can't do it anymore. So pretty much kept it moving forward from there.
In 2014, your band recorded an EP together. Tell me about this.
Well, that was the first, primarily, most of my, although I did some of the recordings with Odyssey and was on some of the albums, mostly my contribution to the group had always been its live performances. I was a musical director, you know, throughout the 80s and, you know, for a time in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And so I was always the guy who put the live shows together. But I have always had production skills, you know, technical skills, et cetera, et cetera. And I felt like in order for us to keep the legacy going, we needed to have more material, you know, new material, plus maybe some remakes of the old material. And so that's how that came about. But at the time, if I can be completely honest, Nile Rodgers from Chic had sort of made his own reemergence, and suddenly he became, you know, the man once again, almost as much as he was back in the 70s and 80s. And little known to a lot of people, Chic had written music for everybody, including Odyssey, and Together was one such song where it was written and actually performed by Nile Rodgers and Bernard Edwards, but it wasn't produced by them. And for some reason, it didn't get I think by that time, they were everywhere, and I think they were, you know, had pretty much done what they were going to do. So that one song, Together, didn't get much traction, didn't get much airplay or anything or much attention at all. Hmm. But since he was back in the news in 2014 and thereabouts, we thought, well, let's revisit that song. And so I sort of brought it up to date. I modernized it a bit, sang the lead myself, and we did that EP. And it did marginally well. At least at the very least, let the world know that I'm still out here, we're still out here, and Odyssey is still going and still making music and going forward.
Next year, have you got gigs already planned for that?
Oh my goodness. Well, I have to tell you, 2020 was already set to be a really banner year. We've got, we had 8 arena gigs with the fabulous Four Tops and the Temptations. You know, opening for lots of major acts all over the country and venues from small theaters right up to arenas.
Yeah.
And then COVID happened. But the good news has been that most of those performances, have, rather than being canceled, have just been postponed.
Yeah.
I think at last count, I think we already have about 50-odd dates. Well, I just want to say that if you want to catch up with us, it's hashtag Odyssey. NYC, that's O-D-Y-S-S-E-Y-N-Y-C. And you can find us on Facebook, Odyssey, the 80s band, or my name, Stephen Collazo. And you can find out where we're going to be and what we're doing and everything. And it'd be lovely to meet everybody, because I never get tired of hearing the stories of how our music has been the backdrop. For so many people's lives. It's always so wonderful. It's a wonderful privilege. And I'd like to thank you for having me.
You're welcome, Stephen. Lovely having you on the show. Now, could you introduce one more song for us to play?
Oh, fantastic. Well, the last song will be an old school expression of what our new motto is today. It's old school meets new school meets old school. That's what Odyssey is today. And to sum that up, our last song would be Going Back to My Roots.
This is Ling Pang for Bond 9 Tunes International, and I talked with Stephen Kalasu of Odyssey.
This is Bondi Tunes International, the week that was.
You're listening to Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting around the world. I'm Henry on a very locked down Bondi Beach in Sydney, Australia, and I'm joined by Thomas Booker, our correspondent in America, in San Antonio de Bayar in Texas. Thomas, welcome to our broadcast. Yeehaw! Hey. I could do with a beer. Have you got a beer?
Oh, yeah. Hang on a second.
Can see, I'm normal. Oh!
There you go. Oh, yeah. Let's around, get this right.
Around the world in less than 3 seconds, 13,000 miles. Thomas gives me a beer here on Bondi Tunes International at 1:05 in the afternoon in Sydney. Hey, Thomas, have you been following our lockdown in the city of Sydney?
I have. I've been actually sharing some of the cartoons.
Yes.
It is a rich ground. It's a fertile ground for growing really great political cartoons. But the situation itself is, I find, incomprehensible. I mean, I don't understand it. I don't understand why there wasn't a full-on vaccine procurement, and why you don't have emergency systems up and running and getting people vaccinated as a priority.
Only 4.3% of the population of Australia is vaccinated, and just keep in mind that there's 25 million people in this country, and it's an absolute disgrace as far as the federal government are concerned, and they're the ones who have been putting out the AstraZeneca virus and others, of course, and they just haven't been doing their job. Now we've got this new variant of the virus, particularly in Bondi. They're actually called, you remember Trump called, you know, the virus the China virus?
Yes.
People are calling this the Bondi virus. I'm not feeling too good about this, I gotta tell you.
Oh my God, the Bondi variation. Ooh, geez, I can't.
Yeah, like it's like we're lepers now. No one wants to talk to us anymore. It's actually drizzling rain on a Monday as we record here in Bondi, and there's no one on the streets. The whole of Sydney is basically locked down, and I would put this, I mean, there's really no time for blame at this point, but the federal government in this country controls the administration of the vaccine or any vaccines, and they have done an appalling job, and now they're going to pay the price, I hope. The other thing is that there's a threat to take off our electricity.
Yes.
At this time, there's a company called Ausgrid who, you know, control the electricity grid.
It sounds like ERCOT here in Texas. It's almost exactly the same tale.
Probably is. Yes, of course. You've had that problem, haven't you? But yes. At this time, and they said they were pre-planned before this virus took off again, the Delta virus, and now they're saying, oh, we have to do it anyway. And I'm thinking, really? I mean, people are locked in their houses, such as me. If our electricity goes off, we have no internet. I have no shower, because I have no cooking, because it's all electric. I don't know, you know, I don't know if it was that bad in Texas when they decided to cut your electricity off, Thomas.
Well, it was, yes. What happened was the system was not hardened against cold weather. And in Texas, we don't have that usually, but there was this amazing dip in the polar vortex that sent this blizzard into our area, and it lasted almost a week. And the city was knocked down below freezing. It did not get above freezing for several days. We had snow. We had... if we have any kind of snow, nobody knows how to drive in it. So we basically shut down our whole traffic situation. People were trapped in their houses, and then the power got...
And no heating. No heating either.
No heating, no electricity. Yes.
You know, I mentioned that it's drizzling. It's winter here in Australia, and it's cold. It is actually cold, and we're not used to this. If they cut our electricity off, then we've got no heating. Mm-hmm. So it's another thing. It's just another thing. Thomas, I want to talk to you about this dreadful shooting that went on in Texas. Somehow this gunman should not have been able to purchase an assault rifle. Now, give us a background to this, if you can. I think there was 26 victims of the Sutherland Springs Massacre on March 30th. Yes.
The Sutherland Springs Church, there's a small town near, Sutherland, Texas. It's a country road outside of San Antonio, about 10 or 15 miles outside the city limits. I'm not even sure if the place is in the same county. I think it's in another county from Bexar County. But this disgruntled fellow, he was having problems with, it was a marital dispute, and he was alienated from his wife. I'm trying to think of the word that used. Estranged. He was estranged from his wife.
Right, yeah.
And had, he was also apparently borderline psychotic, and he was able to procure a semi-automatic rifle, standard Vietnam era kind of semi-automatic rifle. I have to keep. And he went. He drove to but there was a church service and walked in and shot up the whole church,
yes.
Trying to kill her. And it was there was a gentleman in the church, because this is Texas, so. Our Christian churches now, they have people in the congregation who are concealed carry license people. So it being Texas, and then if you believe in the Lord and you believe in the sanctity and the protection of Jesus, it's always a good idea to still carry with you a sidearm, properly
Lord.
Concealed.
I'm just reading from an article here that in four lawsuits filed in Bexar County, victims and family members accused the retailer of negligence for selling this particular rifle fitted.
And
with
it's been the retailer is a sporting goods store that's Texas wide. It's kind of like a Texas institution. And they've been trying to sue that chain.
Are you familiar with that? It's where you are in San Antonio.
Oh yes, we have. It's a sporting chain. I'm trying to remember. At this point right now, I just went blank on it, but it's a.
It's okay. I didn't give you any notice on this, but it doesn't matter.
Well, no, it's just around the corner, but it's basically like an athletic gear. It's all athletic clothing and. Athletic shoes and camping gear and all this other stuff. And then one section of the store, because it's all sports, they have a gun section where you can go buy handguns and rifles and all that.
And just to let our
listeners know,
it's Academy Sports. Yes.
Academy Sports.
We got that at the same time.
Just recovered brain cell. There we go.
Thomas, do you ever, I always find it difficult to understand how Americans are okay with guns and, because... Here in Australia, we really, you can't get a gun unless you are a farmer, basically, or are in the military. Do you ever feel uncomfortable? I mean, you're talking about something that happened in your own town, and San Antonio is not that big. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. It's difficult for me to describe our gun culture to the rest of the world, and it really is... It's insane. I mean, basically, the bottom line is we're really absolutely nuts here. Hmm. I think all of our attitudes from guns and the toxic masculinity and everything else that goes with it basically comes from media. I think it comes from cowboy shows that people grew up with. I think it came from war movies and a military culture that's a military subculture. But it does seem to be tied up with toxic masculinity. It means that the good old boys in this area. I mean, you always have to carry a gun. It's just the way you were raised. And every pickup truck has a rifle rack in it, and it's kind of classic good old boy thing. In our high schools, back when I went to a country high school in Kerrville. There would be a parking lot where the students would park, and they would have pickup trucks. And in the back, in the rear windshield of the pickup truck, you could all see the rifle rack. And so people were there, usually unlocked pickup trucks in the parking lot with rifles. which you think back then in those days, it was unthinkable that anybody would take a rifle into the school and shoot the place up.
I wanted to ask you, actually, sorry, we're going off on a torrent here simply because mm-hmm. we can. We are Bondi teens, and we can talk about whatever the hell we want. But it's interesting, you know, I was watching Anne of Green Gables, Netflix on television, and it was called Anne with an E, and our listeners may have seen that. And it's interesting how the Indian culture, you know, this was set in just before the year 1900, so 1898 or something, and how the Indians were treated in America. Are they, have things, things have obviously improved, but is there some kind of racism against Indians still existing? We've all talked about Black Lives Matter and that kind of stuff, and I'm not saying that problem's fixed, but what about Indians? You don't hear much about them.
Okay, well, yeah, let's call them Native Americans.
Thank you. Columbus. I already knew I was out of date when I said Indians.
Yeah, Christopher Columbus apparently thought he had found part of India when he arrived here, and I just recently was looking at a, when we had Columbus Day, and I was looking at a group, a club of you know, Italian Americans, the people of Italian descent who revere Christopher Columbus, and they were denouncing the negative aspects of him, the reports about what, you know, what a complete and absolute jerk he was. So he's sainted among certain individuals. I'll have to send it to you as an accompaniment. If anybody ever wants to go to your website, there is a painting that's made. It's called Columbia. And it shows this woman, this the spirit of woman, a muse, who's hovering above the land of the United States, sea to sea, and she's behind her is industry and railroads and settlers and white people moving, and as they're sweeping across this image, fleeing. To the left of the image are all the Indian tribes, the Native American cultures, which are deemed inferior and have to be wiped out because of the onslaught, the white men's burden, and this whole expansionist nonsense, which of course at the time Great Britain was implementing in its own way, and Europe was implementing in all the many colonies they were taking over, the Europeanization of the rest of the world, which have left behind destabilized governments, disrupted cultures, and violence and warfare to this day. I mean,
and Native Americans, how are they treated in society? I guess that's what I'm interested in.
Well, at the present time, there's post Trump, there are movements to recognize their autonomy as tribes and recognize the integrity of their tribal nations. As it is, the treaties that were established between the United States and the Native Americans was that they would be accepted as separate nations. And so we have a system of reservations here in the United States where ostensibly the Indian tribes are given autonomy over the bits of land that they were given to live out. Unfortunately, these tribes were placed in god-awful remote areas, and they were not supported in terms of any kind of development or any kind of commerce or anything until a couple of decades ago, when they allowed the Indian tribes discovered that they were autonomous and separate from the United States government, and they began to bring in gambling casinos.
Oh.
And that was and it turned out, you know, that's a god awful. I mean, that's a demeaning and god awful way for them to make a living there. But they brought in revenue to support some of the tribal lands. But in general, in the tribal lands, in their reservations, there's poverty, drug addiction. There's no internet infrastructure. They're barely able to have telephones to function
in this day and age.
Yeah, this day and age, yes. I mean, they're still the lowest priority. However, when Biden came in, Biden administration came in, he did overturn a lot of the insults that the Trump administration was perpetrating against them, and they have actually given the tribal lands autonomy over national parks and national lands. It's about federal lands. Federally owned and federally controlled lands, there is a movement to, and it's actually succeeding, to turn these lands, the management and the care and keeping of these lands, over to Native Americans, which is really a stunning breakthrough. This is and they're trying to expand this so that that way they can give the indigenous nations autonomy and control over resources and lands.
Yes.
And to me, it's a fantastic idea. So it's like giving the Aborigines control over their sacred lands.
There must be such a sense of relief when Trump got ousted. I believe he's trying to make a comeback. I think he's having his first rally, or has he had it already?
He's had it.
How did that go?
I listened to some of it today as much as I could, and it was his standard rhetoric. He's supposed to come to Texas and visit the border because our governor has decided to, as part of his political theater, he's decided to take over control of the building wall on our southern border. So he was going to take a state initiative to finish building the wall that Trump wanted to build. And there's everything against it. It's stirred up a whole lot of rancor and discord. Everybody's talking about the fact that it's the main issues are that he can't fund it. He can't, there isn't any way he can complete it. And there are people on the border who are extremely pissed off that they've had this project rammed through them and rammed down their throats and rammed through their lands and are destroying all of these, archaeological artifacts or archaeological areas, pieces of land, archaeologically sensitive pieces.
And tell me, how's his mate Giuliani?
Oh God! Well, there's
a lot going on with him at the moment. He could end up in jail.
Yes, there's a feeding frenzy. They love, especially New York. I've been watching Colbert and all the other people coming out of New York.
Yes.
And yes,
just to explain, Rudy Giuliani was the president's personal lawyer. He said a lot of bad things and he's done a lot of bad things, and he is threatened with fines, very large fines. We're talking millions, and also jail. Back in 2001, sitting here in my living room in Bondi, when the Twin Towers went down, Rudy Giuliani was the mayor of New York, is that right?
He was the mayor, and he came forward.
And he was a hero. He was a hero.
He was admired far and wide of his men. He did initiate a competent management, competent response to the crisis, to the disaster, and mobilized resources and managed it. And he was apparently a well-grounded, intelligent, competent person at that time. And there's no telling. I mean, one would want to think that maybe there's dementia onset or something else. There might be some aging process contingent to his personality that he's changed.
I tell you, he's still very concerned about the color of his hair, clearly. Mm-hmm. And we all know about that, yes. With the dripping dye going down the side of his face. I just wonder why Rudy Giuliani has not, got his slippers and his pipe and just sit down for the rest of his life, because he's just digging a bigger hole for himself all the time.
Because I guess once again, going back to toxic masculinity, there's power, still being having power and having influence and
all about the power. It really is with politicians, isn't it? I mean, it's a psychological thing.
I'm afraid
thing,
so.
It? Yeah.
I'm terribly afraid so. Yes, unfortunately. There are very few of them having a personal integrity and can stand up for things now.
Do you think politicians, young politicians, go into that game, if you like, well-meaning, and then the game, as in politics, ruins them?
I think so. I think to a large extent it grinds them down. I'm just thinking
of Buttigieg. Is that his name, Pete?
Yeah,
he's young.
He's intelligent, he's competent, and I think that he has the character and the open-mindedness and competence to survive that influence. I have a lot of hope for him. Buttigieg, yeah. He's a sharp person, ex-military. He has creds. He's got credentials out the wazoo.
And talking about creds, for 8 years, Joe Biden was second in charge in America, and now he's the president. He was vice president under Obama. He's certainly got street cred as well. How's he doing?
I would say, I think that he's, right now, he's managing a really...
difficult situation, yes.
Yes, confined. It's a challenge, and it's you know, not anything that you can... It's going to be an easy path through in terms of trying to produce progressive legislation and trying to produce the kind of legislation that's needed to recover the United States at this moment. And unfortunately, the power structure, the power structure of Trumpism is still in place, and it's still blocking him. And it's this, and I'm afraid it's the same stalemate that confronted Obama when he, Mitch McConnell basically declared that all they were going to try to do is keep him to be a one-term president. And I'm fearful. I'm actually very frustrated over the fact that after someone gets elected, after there's a major election, and the people who vote go home, and then they just never bother to be involved thereafter. So the support at the polling places isn't there the next time around.
Yeah, gosh. That's
the same thing that it infuriates me about the Obama administration was that he was abandoned 2 years into his presidency because nobody bothered to go out and vote to keep his support alive in the Senate
and he got two terms.
He did get two terms.
Unlike
Trump, yes.
Do you think we're just randomly talking here, but do you think Trump could get into power in 2022?
I think Trump is dangerous at the present time. And I
could
think
he do it, though? Could he do it?
Well, right now, here in Texas, we have a governor who's gone completely rogue. And we did recently have the Democratic contingent of the state legislature walk out to prevent the governor from having very restrictive voter laws imposed in Texas. And too many other states, they are now writing up these laws that are exclusively trying to prevent minorities and blacks and students and young people from voting. And to have their old, you know, basically they have strictly old white men and their wives vote to restore a conservative, right-wing, fascist regime. And it's very dangerous, actually.
Yes,
we're in peril. We're at present in peril, and we are in Texas.
We got to go soon, but I just want to ask you about how you're managing this virus, and if Delta is Delta in America, and how is it going? What are the percentages, if you have them on hand, which you probably may not, but how well is it going? Because I can tell you 4.3% of Australians have been vaccinated, which is a dire situation.
No, it is. No, your situation is terrible. Mm. We have, I heard this, it was like 80% of the United States has at least one of the vaccine injections going on too. So we're a little over half the population. But the problem now is, initially there was the great wave, there were the people coming in volunteering, and there were, you know, everybody was seeking out their vaccines, and now the number of people wanting to come in and volunteer to get their vaccines is dropping. And it's becoming very incredibly infuriating. And then there's this component, once again, the conspiratorial right wing.
Yes, they'll always be there, won't they?
They'll always be there, and they're refusing to, you know, a lot of people are refusing to get the vaccine for various absurd, stupid reasons. And there is lies and propaganda.
And social media is just not helping the situation. The AstraZeneca virus, which was being administered to people over 50, I think, 50. And they keep changing their minds in Australia because of the blood clot situation. What do Americans think of that in terms of very small, maybe one in a million are dying from blood clots, usually over the age of 50.
I don't think there's that many. There are that many deaths. I think the one major problem they're having right now is that there is a cardiovascular inflammation that comes from some people responding to the second shot of the Moderna or the Pfizer.
And, really, I didn't know that. Gosh.
Oh yeah, there's a.
It's going to happen anyway, isn't it? I mean, it none of these vaccines can be 100% perfect.
Well, what happens is the interesting thing I find is that when you inject the people with the vaccine, what you're doing is you're giving them a simulated infection.
Yes, and of course. It's basically just like the flu.
Just like the flu. Mm. So you train the body to respond to it, and the body does respond to a certain degree. That's why you start feeling the symptoms. And as we've seen, a lot of the symptoms of the full infection are respiratory problems and cardiovascular problems. So it seems to me that, and I'm totally not an expert. I'm just speculating, but I'm thinking that you're simulating the effect of the virus on the body. Your immune system is training, and one of the reactions to it is there to be some inflammation in the areas the heart. You might be having problems with inflammation around the cardiovascular area and the lungs, which happens. Yeah. But it's not a permanent. I mean, it's not disabling or you know, threatening.
It's just kind of a pain in the ass that you gotta do.
It being a pain. It has to be, of course, carefully monitored, and you probably get through it with any inflammatory medication. But it's nowhere near the actual infection. So
yes, and that's the point, isn't it? That's the point.
Yes.
Okay, Thomas, we gotta go. Thank you for randomly talking with me here from lockdown Bondi in Australia.
Your pain.
And I might have another beer later. okay, thank you, Thomas Booker in Texas. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, sir. Y'all hang in there.
This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio.
Nightingale, sing us a song of a love that once belonged. Nightingale, tell me your tale. Was your journey far too long? Does it seem like I'm looking for an answer to a question I can't answer? I don't know which way. To blow it to the left. Nightingale, sing us a song of a love that once belonged. Nightingale, tell me your tale. Was your journey all the voices that are spinning around me, trying to tell me what to say? So can I fly right behind you? You can take me away. Thank you. trying to tell me what to say. So can I fly right behind you? You can take me. You can take me away.
The sun never sets on Bondi Tunes.